our final panelist, and I want to remind you that what we will be doing, Kamika and I will be facilitating an opportunity for you to talk to each other about some of the provocative ideas that you've heard. So stay with us. But now it is my honor to introduce our final panelist speaker, Dr. Jill Stein. Dr. Stein is a mother, a physician, and also a pioneering environmental health advocate. She began advocating for the environment as a health issue in 1998 when she realized that lawmakers were not protecting children because of the influence of corporate money. And I've heard her talk about the fact that at that time she thought, well, here is the problem. The solution is obvious. I'll simply go to the elected officials and show them the science. I'll show them what they need to do. And you know, democracy. So, after that, she worked tirelessly as a leader in the effort to pass full publicly funded elections in the state of Massachusetts. But don't applaud yet, because the Democratic Party-controlled Massachusetts state legislature first refused to fund it, and then they revoked it against the will of the people. That's what led Dr. Jill Stein to understand that she herself had to begin to practice a new type of medicine, political medicine. That's when she became a genuine leader within the Green Rainbow Party of Massachusetts. She has run for President of the United States in 2012 and 2016, fought tirelessly for demanding recounts in not one, not two, but three states. Dr. Jill Stein.
Maybe this one? Okay, great. Yeah, the challenge about being introduced by David is that living up to the power of your introduction. So, and not only that, but you know, following this amazing set of panelists, I just want to say hats off. You said it all. I have nothing to add. Just I want to agree with them and underscore how absolutely right they are. And you know, what I have learned in my 25 years of organizing as a electoral dissident, public enemy, you could say, what I have learned is, in fact, what they have said, which is that it is these struggles in frontline communities, in communities of color, in low-income communities, that really is the glue that binds us. These are the human rights struggles that express our common humanity, and these are the narratives that bring us together in a powerful human struggle. So I just want to agree and thank you for your leadership and for your courage, because at the end of the day, it is that courage, it is that vision that I think electrifies us and ignites us and moves us to where we need to go. That is ultimately the engine that drives us to social and political change. It is the courage of your struggles. So thank you, these wonderful panelists, leaders. I want to give a shout out also to some of the other women in the room coming from frontline communities and communities of struggle who are also leading the charge. I want to say a thank you to Allison Rendon from Standing Rock, who is here with us. And we're going to talk a little bit more about Standing Rock and how Standing Rock stands for us all. I also want to give a shout out to Samantha Priest-Denson for standing up and fighting so many guys. And Samantha is running for the House of Representatives, or is it City Council?
City Council.
City Council. Yeah. So if you're in Minneapolis, tune in. And I also want to acknowledge Paula Overly, if I have the name right, who is also one of our trans sisters, who is leading this project as well. So a big thank you to all of you. I guess I want to start by just agreeing with what has been said several times tonight, which is that this really is the existential moment. You know, this is the ultimate moment of crisis. This is kind of the do or die moment. It's not only the violence being perpetrated on communities of color. It's not only the millions of people serving unjustly thrown into our prison system who should not be incarcerated in the first place and who should be liberated along with legalizing marijuana, which is safer than substances that corporations are making billions of dollars off of peddling. Marijuana is actually safer than nicotine and then alcohol, and millions of people should not be locked up, should not then be burdened with the label of being a felon and denied their voting rights or their housing rights or their access to loans and to school. All of that should be done away. We should not be struggling as a generation of young people and not so young people, 44 million people burdened by unpayable, predatory student loan debt, which cannot be paid back. We bailed out the crooks on Wall Street who crashed the economy. It is time to bail out the students who are the victims of that credit card. And while we're at it, to make public higher education free, it should be a human right. It pays for itself, we know that. For every dollar that we put into higher education, we get back $7 in return. Congress established that very clearly during the GI Bill following the Second World War. There is no excuse not to be providing free public higher education right now, as well as health care, as a human right, through a Medicare for All system. And yes, Obamacare is better than Trump care, there's no doubt about it, but the crisis of Trump care, it is actually, it's a crisis of Obamacare as well. And the real solution here is to move to a single payer system, and why not do it now? Unfortunately, there were some talking points that were circulating in Congress as part of the healthcare debate, which basically listed all the reasons why Trump care was terrible, but didn't say a word about single payer as the ultimate solution to that. Plus, we have in the case of California, where the Speaker of the Assembly, a Democrat, actually took single payer off the table when it was about to be passed by the second legislative house in California, which essentially would have enacted it in California. So, you know, it's not only that, you know, that Trump is a disaster, but he's not just a symptom of a sick political system. He is also the sickness itself. But let me, you know, underscore that he is also that symptom of a diseased political system. When people voted for Donald Trump, polls show us they were not actually voting for Trump. The majority was actually voting against Hillary Clinton and the legacy of neoliberalism. And it's a tap, because we are in that kind of do or die moment right now. Neoliberalism has come back to bite us in a very big way. And if you throw people under the bus systematically for decades on jobs, on wages, on healthcare, on education, on, you know, sending our jobs overseas, on spending more than half of our discretionary dollars on a military budget that is making us less secure, not more secure, we don't have the dollars that we need here at home. So all of this is part of that kind of neoliberal, corporate, capitalist, predatory policies that have been followed by two parties. So neoliberal the way to this neo-fascism, which is why, as others have said, the real solution here to Donald Trump and the problem of right-wing extremism is a truly radical, progressive agenda that we're all about here at this conference. And thank everybody for standing up today. So just, you know, I also want to agree that racism is not separate from this crisis. As Martin Luther King said, we have this triple problem of racism, of extreme materialism, and of militarism. They go hand in hand with each other. We cannot solve one of them without solving them all. But in fact, they are quite solvable. And that's why, you know, we're not going to fix this around the margins. We're not going to fix this with Obamacare. You know, we're going to fix this with a really systemic solution, with a set of radical solutions that includes healthcare and education as human rights and a job, not only a job, but a job at a living wage as a human right and the right to a union while we are at it.
That's right.
We need that radical agenda. We need a systemic shift. We need a real system change if we are going to get out of this century alive. And what it's coming down to is not just this century, but perhaps even this decade or the next two decades. What we're looking at right now on the Korean Peninsula, and I just came back, I had the honor of traveling with Medea Benjamin and Code Pink and with U.S. Labor Against the War and with Veterans for Peace. We all went together as part of a peace delegation to South Korea, basically to support the South Korean people who have been living in a battlefield of the great powers for a century. And they have said, enough is enough. We don't want your friggin' weapons, and we don't want your friggin' war, is what the South Korean people are saying. They are fighting to get rid of our weapons, this THAAD missile system, this so-called missile defense, which is really not a defense. It's a Trojan horse, actually, for a very powerful radar system to go and spy on China. You know, you can't just take regime change, like the success that it's been, right, in the Middle East. There's this bipartisan illusion that we can just take regime change and move it from the disaster in the Middle East and just move it to Southeast Asia, or actually Northeast Asia in this case, to the Korean Peninsula, add in nuclear weapons, add in China and Russia, which have long had a stake in the Korean Peninsula, and think that we're going to get out of here alive. There's no way that we can go forward with this regime change concept of foreign policy, this foreign policy based on essentially economic and military domination, which also is bankrupting justice here at home for the American people. The war at home on black people and brown people is paralleled by the war abroad, in which our misleaders and our military are bombing seven other countries at a minimum that we know of around the world, and essentially have become an occupying force with somewhere near 1,000 bases in over 100 countries around the world. You know, it took me a long time to realize this rarely acknowledged fact that if you add up all the other countries around the world who have foreign bases, it comes to something like 20 or 30 altogether. All other countries put together have a handful of bases, but somehow we have 1,000 bases and think that that's okay. That's, you know, this is a police state, you know, essentially waiting to collapse. It actually is collapsing. There was a recent report put out, I think, by the Defense Department which said that it's not working, and what was the response of the Defense Department? Oh, we gotta pour more money into it. As if more than half of our discretionary budget is enough. So just to make the point that, you know, we are sort of in a couple of cold wars right now. One is on the border of Russia, where we said we wouldn't move one inch to the east at the time of German reunification. We weren't gonna move one inch east of Berlin with NATO and our missiles and our nuclear weapons, but now they basically surround Russia. So there are reasons why Russia is a little bit, shall we say, touchy and paranoid right now about troops on their border. I think we would be touchy about troops on our border and missiles and nuclear weapons on our border. So that's one Cold War that's getting very hot. And then there's this other Cold War which is heating up right now. So it's really important that we stand up, not only to end racism, to end this hyper-materialism, aka predatory disaster capitalism, but we also have to stand up against militarism, and we gotta do all those things at once, you know, and to my mind, obviously any one of us can't do all of that, but we're all plugging in, and by us all plugging in, we become a very powerful force, especially as we link arms and we connect as movements of movements. And that's what's really different about right now. I think not only that we are in this existential moment, we are in this kind of do or die moment, this moment when the clock is ticking. The clock is ticking on the nuclear weapons. The clock is ticking on the climate meltdown. The clock is ticking on the economic collapse, on the war on black and brown people in this country and around the world, on a generation of students. The clock is ticking, but we are mobilized like we have never been before. And we are facing this unprecedented crisis, but we are now a movement of resistance that is unstoppable and like something we have never seen. So I want to thank everybody for being a part of that movement. I'm just gonna rattle off a couple things real quickly, which I think are really important points of convergence right now. And that includes ranked choice voting. I just wanna give that a shout out because ranked choice voting, we can kiss goodbye to this lesser evil voting, this sense that you gotta vote your fears. You have to vote against the person you hate the most instead of for the person who really reflects your views, your values. What is democracy if the only question when you go to the polls is who do I hate the most? It doesn't really set the agenda for us. It doesn't really inspire us forward. It's really important for us to be able to vote our values. Ranked choice voting, as you all probably know, it lets you rank your choices. So if your first choice loses, your vote is automatically transferred to your second choice. So it ensures that no vote is thrown away, no vote is wasted, and it ensures that our values lead the way forward, which is what democracy needs. It needs a moral compass. And I just wanna end here, you know, again, there are a number of electoral reforms that I think are really important, but I'm not going to take the time to mention them. You can go to any of many websites and find out, including ours or our Facebook page. Let me just say quickly, I want to rattle off a couple things that really are achievable because we have huge numbers behind them, and they will make a huge difference. So Medicare for all, as we said. 100% renewable energy by 2030. And that means a complete end to any new fossil fuel infrastructure starting right now. It means bail out the students, free public higher education right now. An end to police brutality, ensure that we have commissions so that communities are controlling their police and not the other way around. We need a Green New Deal now. That means the right to a job at a living wage for everyone. That job transforms our economy to clean renewable energy, a healthy, sustainable local food system, and public transportation, and restores our ecosystems. There was a report that just came out last week, virtually ignored by the press, about the sixth great extinction. 30% of elephants have disappeared in the last 7 years. An elephant goes down every 50 seconds, and they will be gone in the next decade, along with a lot of other animals. And it's not just like goodness of our hearts, but this is the web of life in which we live. And that web goes down, we go down with it. If you're going to survive an extinction, you have to be the size of a squirrel or smaller. There aren't many of us that qualify for that. So, you know, it's just another reason why this is that critical moment and why we need a Green New Deal now. It will fix that. And ecosystem restoration is part of stopping this extinction crisis. And finally, a foreign policy not based on economic and military domination, which is what the guideposts of the bipartisan foreign policy is right now, but instead a foreign policy based on international law, human rights, and diplomacy. And by the way, again, not covered by the press, is the fact that it is now against the law to have nuclear weapons. That is now a UN treaty that will come into place. Finally, a big salute to the human rights struggles that lead us forward. And that means Black Lives Matter. It is the Dreamers and the immigrant rights movement who stood up with so much courage. Why should immigrants, who are essentially refugees from misguided US policies, from regime change, from the war on drugs, killed 100,000 people in Mexico alone in the last 5 years, NAFTA. Why should people who have fled here for their lives then be criminalized and sent back at great peril? They should be welcomed. This is the backbone of our society, of our culture, of our community. And again, a thank you to Standing Rock, which has been standing not only for their rights, but for the rights of us all, for not only for indigenous sovereignty, but for democracy and for the right to protest peacefully, which they were not allowed. They were brutally suppressed. Vinnie Jolie! For protecting our water, protecting our air, protecting our climate. It's the courage of these struggles in Flint, in Detroit, in frontline communities across the country and across the world. We are beginning to connect with each other, to connect the dots. Together we are unstoppable. We do have the power to create not only an America that works for all of us, but an America and a world that works for all of us. The power is in our hands. Thank you for making it.
Maybe this one's a little better. All right, now please stay with us so that we can have a nice discussion after this. But before that, I want to share some words from one of my friends and comrades in this movement, Sherry Hongla, who is the National Director of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, who says, "We cannot overcome oppression or build inclusion without figuring out how we can share. We've got to be better at sharing with each other."
Now what we're going to ask y'all to do, we've heard some provocative words. I'm going to ask you to stay in groups of three or four and have a conversation. And I'm actually going to push a little bit because try to weave a thread to make a provocative question. Because Keith Ellison had the courage to say the F word in public. Did y'all hear him?
Yeah.
Yep. He said fascism. Woo! Jennifer talked about the fact that democracy is not liberation, but liberation is not possible without democracy. Both Jackie and Jill repeatedly talked about the system and changing the system. So here's my provocative question to you when we're talking about a democracy movement and systems and liberation. And here's the question in groups of three or four. We'll give you 10 minutes to have this conversation. Can we have democracy? Can we have liberation within an economic system of capitalism where a small ruling elite literally control the economic decisions? That's the question. I'm going to put it to you. Have these conversations with yourselves because, see, I am in it to win it. And when I say win, I am a revolutionary. I ain't scared to say it. And by that, I mean I want to transform the systems in which we live. I know that this system is racist, sexist, and class oppressive. I know the transnational corporations are destroying the planet. I'm going to tell you this. I personally believe that we are going to have to actually create new structures, new systems, new political, economic, and social systems. So in groups of three or four, y'all turn to each other and feel free to disagree with one another. Have that conversation. Thank you.